David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you're listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. We'll be discussing the final seven chapters to the end, to the demise of Thorin, spoiler alert, to Bilbo's return, to Tolkien setting up other stories, and to peace on Earth for a while. We're also going to talk about luck here in a second, but first, Heidi, how's it going?
It's going great over here. Spring has arrived.
It's not snowing?
No, it's beautiful. Like, beautiful enough that I should be out working in my garden to prepare it to plant. But that is a thing I think about every day, but I have not done it.
Instead, make a metaphor. The metaphor could somehow apply to this podcast.
I have to read The Hobbit. It's my actual job.
Could be worse.
Yeah. Sorry. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Also, nice weather here. We had some storms come through and cool it off. And,
oh, yes. Probably the same ones that we had.
Yeah, I can imagine so.
Some storms came up from the south, worked their way north, went off towards the ocean, is my understanding.
Yeah. But, yeah. Like the storm is wont to do.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sure there's a segue here with storms and things like that as and moving off into the ocean as far as The Hobbit goes. But we posted, or I said that people should post on the thread why their kids like this book. And we did get a few responses related to that, or to that question. But we are actually recording this episode 2 days after the previous episode went up. And so what I'm going to do is invite people to post that, you know, continue to post those as if you'd like. And then when we do our Q&A episode on the next episode, in addition to answering some questions, we will share some of that feedback there because we just didn't give people enough time. So I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to use the two or three people that responded to that in the 36 hours since the episode went up. So we'll save that.
Just but good job for being quick.
I know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thanks for being on it. So again, we'll add that to the Q&A, which of course brings me to the Q&A. That is our next episode. Next time we will answer your questions about The Hobbit, and be sure to check out the thread over on Substack at closereads.substack.com and post your questions. And we'll be recording that episode. We always record the Q&As as late as possible in the week so that it's like actually on the day that it's supposed to go up usually, so that it gives people more time to actually get a question in. So feel free to do that at your leisure, and we will get to as many as we can as usual. Also, a reminder that Sean has been doing the Daily Poem, and it's pretty good, and you should check it out. And that's dailypoempod@substack.com. We also have Withy Windle is back. Graham and I have kicked off season 7 of Withy Windle with great guests and snacks as usual and all our nonsense that we're up to over there. We also have the bonus episodes for our subscribers over at Substack as well. We're working our way through Christian Lavransdatter. We're almost done with the second volume in that trilogy. So to everyone who's been participating in that, thank you so much. Thanks to Sean and Heidi for doing that without me last time. I appreciate that. The comments were really good. Sounds like you guys did a good job. I don't know. It sounds like you guys did a great job without me.
Without you.
We were still coasting on the momentum from the last episode with you.
I think you're just trying to pander at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
But you guys, the truth of the matter is you don't really need me for any of those conversations. And I'm rethinking things about how I use my time now. And also how I use your time.
See, that's so, what I'm afraid of.
Yeah, exactly right. What did you say, Heidi? Oh yeah, Heidi, I can't hear you. Sean, can you hear her?
I can't hear you, Heidi.
I think maybe, did your mic come unplugged?
Oh boy.
Sean, tell a joke, hurry up. Tell a riddle.
What do you get when, I don't know, I got no jokes. I don't know any jokes.
You got no jokes?
Yeah.
The count grew, he slowed down and he began to get shaky and weepy, for he was leaving the water further and further behind and he was getting afraid, is a line in this book that we're talking about.
Are you still gone?
Oh, you're back. We can hear you now.
Oh, good.
Phew. Okay.
Phew.
Well, that was odd. That was just an unlucky moment there, and which is, you know, it works out because we need to talk about luck this week. Yes. And in particular, we talked about, last week we kind of used the question of luck to enter into our conversation, but never really got into it too much. And there was actually a comment on the thread from Crystal Did I miss you all talking about the luck theme? You promised. I noticed it on this read and was curious about it. So we need to talk about it. And it's probably just as good to wait till the final episode here, because the book ends with this very important note about luck, in which Gandalf actually tells Bilbo, surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself. You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit? You're a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I'm very fond of you, but you were only quite a little fellow in a wide world after all. Thank goodness, said Bilbo, laughing, and handed him the tobacco jar. So we need to talk about luck. But before we talk about luck, we also just need to talk about some of the plot machinations and the way this story ended. I had forgotten how, I don't know if anticlimactic is the word, but how quickly Smaug is gone, and how the, right. and how, like, basically it happens off screen. It doesn't really happen off screen, if you'll pardon the, I mean, Bard shoots him, but it kind of happens quickly, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't come back to the mountain. He doesn't go destroy the city and then come. There's just things that when you haven't read it in a while, the how quickly things happen, I'd forgotten. And then also the battle, in true Tolkien fashion, a lot of it happens while someone's asleep, which I love. It's great. It's like great action writing for like four pages, and then Bilbo gets bonked on the head. He gets bonked on the head and then wakes up, and you get it summarized later. And what I wanted to ask you is quite simple. Maybe it's not, but it seems the question is simple. Why do you think Tolkien does that? Like, why do you think for him, like, he clearly can write a good battle scene. He's read enough Iliad and Beowulf to write a good action scene. In fact, some of those passages feel a lot like those particular books. Yeah. He wears his influences out in the open and I was going to say for better or for worse, but I think it's just for better. But why does he not give us all the stuff that happened when Bilbo got knocked out? And why does the dragon get killed so much faster than you expect? The whole book, you're like, oh, they got to get to the dragon and it's going to be terrible.
What about
and
the dragon?
And then the dragon flies away and gets shot with an arrow. Partly because Bilbo was smart and saw, you know, the weakness. But he doesn't make a big deal out of it. Why is it? I vamped long enough. Heidi, what do you think?
I think it's funny that you say that, because I was remembering reading this for the first time as a child.
Mm.
And or having it read to me. Mm. And being disappointed. And feeling like I kind of lost the thread of the story at this point, because I expected a big climactic moment with Smaug, and Smaug's the villain of the story. And they finally, kind of like a video game, you get to like the top level of the video game. And then once it's defeated, then the game's over, you know?
Credits. Yeah.
And I kind of didn't know what category to put the rest of the book in. It felt like almost like the Scouring of the Shire does in Lord of the Rings, when it's like, well, I mean, once Smaug is dead, that's the end. But Tolkien clearly doesn't want that to be the case. Like he doesn't want us to treat the story like that. And he continually points back to Bilbo. Like, Bilbo is the main character, and there are ways that Bilbo rises to like heroic stature. And then there's ways Bilbo remains always a simple hobbit. And I think that in these final chapters, we're continually brought back to that, because he's preparing us to take him back to the Shire, right? And it is the simple, ordinary virtues of Bilbo that make him heroic. And so he keeps kind of forcing the story back to Bilbo's capacities, what Bilbo is great at, what's being asked of him. And I think that that's part of the purpose as we get towards the end. I think there's some other things too, Sean, I want to hear, but I don't want to monopolize. So I'll pass off to you.
I think that's great. And I think too that this continues some of the playful interaction with the fantasy genre that he's writing in. Right, we talked in previous episodes about the sort of jabs or the breaking of the fourth wall almost, where he calls out different tropes of the genre. You know, the fact that there are no heroes to be found, and that sort of thing. And here, I think he's working on the assumption that we have that the dragon fight is going to be the climactic part of the story, because it always is. And then he whisks the dragon out of the way, and what is left is largely a drama over greed, right? And it's human temptation. Vices.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really not Tolkien's so clever. He doesn't have to like spell any of this out, but it's really not that the battle wasn't with the dragon. It's that the characters who remain become the dragons. Thorin sits on his hoarded treasure in his mountain, just like Smaug was. And Bilbo, who probably wasn't equal to mortal combat with Smaug, is, as you said, right, is the hero. And so he has to fight this different kind of dragon in a different kind of way that he's particularly suited to. And so it is surprising, but, you know, it's the kind of surprise that maybe catches you off guard as a child, but as an older reader, is really a satisfying kind of surprise.
Right. I agree with that. And it seems that Tolkien, in his, I don't know if it's a subversive way, but pretty much like what you're saying, Sean, the way of saying it is that the real villain of the story is like the dragon sickness, right? And the dragon, of course, is infected by it and the infector. But the complexities of inheritance and ownership kind of put in parallel lines next to greed and temptation and the validity of the claims.
Yeah.
Can't really be explored if Smaug is kind of this simple villain to be eliminated, and then it's just whoever gets the gold, right? And so I really like what you said about kind of getting him out of the way. He's really important, but there's a lot more work that the story is doing once he's eliminated that actually just makes it, I think, much more complex and satisfying.
Yeah, he's not a throwaway. He's not, in movie terms, he's not a MacGuffin that's just there to move the plot along. Part of the final conflict is the irony that these characters who were worried about the dragon for so long could become unwittingly, you know, a replacement dragon.
Right.
Ultimately, the goblins are more of a villain in the book than he is.
Yeah, true. Right.
Because they don't generate the battle at the end, but they're like the big bad at the end. They're the one who they're running from all throughout. I mean, I guess there's the trolls, but I was thinking about how you have, if you look at the different, you have like your cave dwellers and you have your above ground dwellers, your forest dwellers, whatever. So you got the people and the elves that live above the ground and the wizards. And then you've got the goblins and the dragon and Gollum and kind of also the dwarves, who are all happiest underground. And so I find that pretty interesting. And then you've got the hobbits who live in a hillside, which is kind of like a cave. But that's why that opening line is so good, because it's a cave, but it's a comfortable cave. It's a hobbit cave. And so like they're bridging this world that talks about how he loves the grass, but all he wants, he loves the grass in the woods, but he also just wants to sit in his hobbit hole. And so like he's bridging the worlds, the worlds of the underground where the dragon and Gollum live, and the dwarves are like sort of, they live there as well, but they haven't fully given in to, you know, the dragon, the dragon, the dragon sickness, although yeah. They're never quite far from it. Like they're always showing the symptoms a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then Bilbo himself is kind of divided. Like you've got the Took side and the Baggins side, right? And the Took side like sends him on the journey. But then when he gets back, at the end, it says that he's not really able to be a part of it because he's participated in something that no one else has, and his own self is divided, and the ring represents all of that in the future books as well. But so then all that comes into focus more when the dragon is kind of disposed of. But do you think that this is the part of the book that makes it more than a kid's book? Is the ending what takes it from being like the typical juvenile adventure book? And I don't mean juvenile in a negative way, just like genre way.
Yeah.
Sean, what are you going to say?
Oh, yeah. 100%. The sort of arch drama that develops in the end, I think doesn't by any means make it inaccessible to children. But I think it's definitely what gives it a sort of lasting appeal. Right. You have that. That exchange between Thorin and Bard, when Thorin says, if you had come here and found us all dead, right, would you have paid a share of the treasure to our family members, our kinsmen? And that's just such an adult dramatic situation that's developing there suddenly. A sort of adult ethical question that really does deepen the story pretty rapidly.
I think one of my favorite things about Tolkien is that he manages to tell a tale with a point and with like a clear moral vision without it becoming like an activist allegory. And I love that. I especially love it in the dwarves in this, and the elves, but more the dwarves in this book. Because they have this troubling temptation, and they're like a little bit ridiculous sometimes, especially like Bomber, right? And each of them has their own unique personality, their own capacity for temptation and for heroism. They're just real. And they have a clear identity, like a dwarf has this kind of nature, but it's not so straightforward that it's just purely good or purely evil. Like they're just, I dare say, human, right? They're dwarfish. And I think that's one of the things that makes Tolkien so great at world building, among so many other things. That's what he's justly known for. Is that not only does he go into this meticulous detail of creating a believable, relatable, complete world, but each of the races within it are the same way. And so he gives us a story that is a cautionary tale against greed without being simplistic and without being activist. But it does give us this kind of really compelling vision for a world in which people fall to the temptation of greed and in which people rise to overcome it. And we enter into it and we take a side without simplifying the complexity of the question.
So speaking of the complexity of a question, do you think that the book, like, do you think Tolkien views Bilbo's choice to take the Arkenstone and give it to the Bard and basically to Thorin's enemies, do you think he views that as like virtuous, like ultimately without any complication of virtuous choice?
Sean?
This would make a great essay topic for kids, actually.
It really would. Yeah. It's a fascinating question. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you asked a bunch of kids that question,
yeah,
I bet they wouldn't have the same answers.
No, I think you would definitely get different answers. I think that, we talked last episode about the way in which Gandalf acts as the moral compass for the story. And to that degree, I think we do get a commendation for Bilbo's choice, right? Gandalf.
He jumps out of his cloak and says,
yeah. Yeah, well done.
Well done.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think particularly because of the way in which he has to do this subversive thing really in service of these people that he cares about, these dwarves that he's come to love. it's not as if he's being malicious, and it's not as if he's betraying them to their enemies. What he's really trying to do is save Thorin from his dragon sickness, right? From his self-destructive desires here. And I think that Tolkien more or less commends that. And he does go to some trouble to explain like the moral gray area that Bilbo finds himself in. Like, well, they did say he could have his pick of the treasure as his 14th. Yeah. And Bilbo stands on that several times. And he admits, well, okay, I'm sure that he probably didn't have this particular object in mind. But, you know, contract's a contract.
It's just another way that the book sort of like plays with anticlimax and plays with your expectations. And the whole book, he's on this journey with them. And then in the end, he leaves them, you know?
Right, right. Yeah.
He burgles his way out.
Exactly.
That was going to be my comment, is that he kind of redefines burglar there, because that is his maybe sole significant burgling. He takes the cup bit earlier, right? Like, but that calling him a burglar leads you to this moment. Yes. And there is a nobility and honor to it. And also it's framed with honor, right? Like, he has all of these choices to like save himself in there. Like, he could stay with the elves. He's invited to stay there.
He chooses
to go back because he gives a promise to Bomber. He doesn't want to get Bomber in trouble.
That's
And so Tolkien gives him these like moments of kind of high self-sacrifice in the midst of it. That reminds us how noble he is.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do a great job explaining it to, like, Tolkien doesn't give him the right words in the moment. Like, every time I read it, I'm like, oh, you could say it better when he's talking to the Elven King. And Bard asks him, are you betraying your friends? And he doesn't explain it really.
Right.
So I do think that it's intentionally clear. Like, it's very clear that he stole it and burgled it, as you said. I really like that as a verb, by the way. Burgle. Why don't we say that more often? I just like it. Sounds good. But
I don't know. It's
framed in these kind of high moral terms as well in the story.
And part of that is because I think so many of his actions and choices could be understood in a different way.
Yeah.
Like the stealing of the ring, for example, in a way he happens upon it luckily, right? And maybe taking the ring itself is not a problem, but as we talked about earlier, what about the way he tricks Gollum? Like, he doesn't really play the game. Mm-hmm. And so because questions like that come up, it brings into focus the question of like honor even more so. And Bilbo not being a perfect hero allows Tolkien to contemplate heroism. Same with Thorin, right? Like, it allows him to contemplate heroism in the way that, you know, Homer does.
Yeah.
Because what hero is not at some point either Don Quixote or like, I don't know. And that's the ridiculous version of a hero. Like, occasionally they drift that way. And sometimes they drift into, I don't know, pick your hero who makes a bad choice in some story. I don't, off the top of my head, Thorin, sometimes you're Thorin.
Yeah.
That's right.
Or sometimes frankly, Achilles, right?
Right.
Sometimes you just have a lot of rage, which also that brings us to Thorin. And actually, now that I think about it, there's a lot of Achilles and Thorin comp. Something gets taken from him that he thinks is justly his or rightly his. And then people.
Doesn't matter
die.
Who's going to die over it. Yeah.
There's nobody getting shot in the ankle exactly, though. But he does get shot with arrows.
Not in the Iliad either, actually. Right. So
that's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, David, that reminds me of there was a part of your question earlier that we kind of that we haven't come back to, and that's the brevity with which the battle unfolds.
Mm. Yes, yes.
And I'm probably going to make some people upset because this is not the kind of thing that you can really gripe about safely. But there, a lot is made. Like, there are countless books that are written about how Tolkien's experience in World War One, you know, shapes his fiction. And some of them go so far as to basically read like the Lord of the Rings as allegories for the world wars. And I don't really care a lot about that.
Neither did he. Neither
but yeah, right. And which is why I think that it's a problematic approach. But however, it is clear from a biographical standpoint that his experience in the war really affected him. And I think that that's one of the reasons the battles in his books are the way that they are. Mm-hmm. He's happy to give you the after report and acknowledge the valorous deeds done by people in the battles. But he's not interested. I mean, this is a guy who was at the Somme, right? He's not interested in battlefield violence for entertainment's sake, because he lived through battlefield violence and lost friends. And I think, you know, you can sort of chalk it up to that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. He doesn't want to, he respects valor and honor, but he doesn't turn it into like the gladiator. It's not a, are you not entertained? He gets right to the edge of the battle being a great exciting thing. And then right as it seems like, you know, no one really gets their Aristea, right? Right as it seems like someone might, he pulls the plug and literally knocks you out.
Yeah, he doesn't have nobody in his books is skating downstairs on a shield shooting orcs, you know, or surfing down an elephant's trunk.
Which in some ways I think is actually one of the things that maybe makes it difficult to know how to adapt, because those are the kind of visual flourishes you would need in a movie.
That's right.
And so you have to add those things in, because he doesn't give you the Oristea of...
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't give you... he does give the Gimli and Legolas having a competition over how many orcs they're going to kill. He gets stuff like that, right. But
even that is sort of bookends the actual battle in the books more than you see it unfolding.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel, Heidi. I mean, this is like a borderline inappropriate question, probably to ask it. How do you feel? I don't mean like that. How do you, as a woman, like, are you like just good? The battlefield stuff is over. I don't know how you feel about violence and battles in books. No, I don't mean. I don't mean like that. Like, is it just like I don't need another? I don't need 10 more pages of a battle. Like, I'm fine with just let's just move on.
Yeah.
But you're perfectly happy with it.
I am a very girly girl and a very typical I think battle scenes are. I get weary of them. I get fatigued on them more easily.
Yeah, yeah.
So this
is perfect.
I do. Yeah. I appreciate this. And one thing I like about it is, again, he's not an activist writer, but he is very concerned with the recovery of a sense of valor and virtue in stories in the 20th century. And so what he describes in a battle is intentional, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it is to the the danger, like the building danger. If there's any treachery or vice, he will highlight that. If there's any extraordinary valor or virtue, he will highlight that. On a technical level, I think he still manages to build a battle towards a climax and a satisfying kind of tale. Right. He doesn't sacrifice that in his choices, in my opinion, at least. And then kind of the meaningful nature of what's happening, right? To go back to the question of luck, he's continually, and in this and in Lord of the Rings and in Silmarillion, right? Like he's always kind of, if something's in the nick of time, like the eagles, you know.
There's or the ring. He finds the ring at the exact right time.
That's exactly. Right. Like he kind of makes that part of the question of the stories. He's intentional about that. He doesn't let them just be luck or deus ex machina, right? Like he might leave them mysterious, that he makes the characters talk about the mystery in some way.
Yeah, they're aware of it, yeah.
Yeah, and the story itself is aware of it, and I think that that's part of the question that he's raising, although in a different way from Cormac McCarthy, having just read The Road, we had this same conversation, and Cormac McCarthy has an actual existential question about luck and meaning, right? Whereas Tolkien, I think, is raising the question of luck and answering it with the answer of this is a meaningful world. It's a meaningful literary space. And by extension, it's a meaningful world that we live in now. It's a comic world, not a tragic one, right? And that's intentional within his stories. And that's part of what he was doing with his stories.
And at the end of the book, the passage that I read, he ties it to the prophecy, to the old yes. songs. So what is Gandalf saying here at the end? And I'll read this again. So they're talking about Bard and how the new master is of a wiser kind. The old master, well, he died of starvation in the waste, deserted by his companions. Stories of wiser kind, said Balin, and very popular. For of course, he gets most of the credit for the prosperity. They're making songs which say that in his day, the rivers run with gold. Then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true after a fashion, said Bilbo. And then here's this line again from Gandalf. Why should not they prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand bringing them about yourself. You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit? You're a very fine person, Mr. Brand, and I'm quite very fond of you, but you're only quite a little fellow in a wide world after all. Thank goodness, said Bilbo, laughing, and handed him the tobacco jar. So what is it? What is the implications of the question of luck in this book when you tie them to the old songs, when you tie them to the prophecies? What is Tolkien getting at? What does that mean? Does it mean that it isn't luck after all? Is that what he's suggesting? That it's something more like fate? Or is it... Or what? And I can think of a number of options, but like maybe the right. biggest question, the biggest place to start is just a matter of is what he's suggesting here, that there's a fate that the songs are speaking to. I wanted to see who would go first.
Hi, do you have any thoughts on
this? Sure. I do have thoughts on this. I can't help but read this in light of Lewis's work as well. Specifically thinking of a really significant moment in his novel Perelandro, which we read on the show, when Ransom has contributed to protecting Perelandra from a great evil. And he has been like grievously wounded, but is healing from that good and faithful servant moment. And the angels or the Oyarsa who are speaking to him, he's fallen on his face and he's weeping and he's overwhelmed by the part that he has played. And he's told by the Oyarsa, this angelic being, he's like, basically he tells him like, calm down. Like this, it was you, you did something great, but if it wasn't you, it would have been somebody else. And it wasn't really your work. It was the work of Melaldil, who is, you know, God in the story. And I think the complexity of that is like enduringly fascinating to definitely to Lewis. And I think to Tolkien too, especially as writers, as authors, because when you write a story, you are essentially Melaldil, right? You are the figure that is drawing everything right. towards its inevitable end. And for them, they're writing a Christian story. And the Christian story that they are writing is what I just said a few minutes ago. This is a comic world, this is a world that is not tragic in nature. We are not declining. We are moving towards a consummation devoutly to be wished, right? And we might be in the middle of it when things are bad and it feels like a tragedy, but every story has that moment. And there is an intervention and a hero who comes to rescue and save and put things to right. And the world will be restored in the end. And so I think that kind of conundrum, the mystery that's raised by that, the interaction of the character's free will with the author's, whether divine or human's, will that's moving towards the inevitable comic end, is interesting to Tolkien and Lewis, and they put that into their stories. And without trying to solve it, although Lewis is a little bit more overt with it, because he is with everything, right? Tolkien puts it into his stories that there is this overarching will that is good, that it's benevolent, that is salvific, and intervening. But the characters themselves are the vehicles of that will, but they also maintain their own free will. And they also live in very real and precarious danger in which things could go wrong. And The Hobbit, of course, as a children's story, is a little bit more light on the touch of that than Lord of the Rings.
But it sets it up here. I mean, at the end of the book, it sets
that
it up.
Question seriously. It takes the question seriously of like, Bilbo always has free will and he might die and he could choose not to do this. But the fact is that he did, which does speak to him, but also speaks to the kind of this overarching benevolence that is moving towards a cosmic redemption for Middle Earth. And that paradox and mystery is always there in the stories.
Yeah, and the aspect too that Gandalf seems to touch on when he says, "But you don't really suppose that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit?" Right? Is also that we can sometimes think that if providence or divine benevolence is either sort of doing things on a cosmic level that really don't touch us individually, or is looking out for us in the particular sense. And we don't often conceive of those two things overlapping. Right. And so there's also that aspect of Bilbo being preserved through his dangers and adventures, as an individual, and right, maybe even having the thought to thank his lucky stars, but missing the way in which that localized individual providential protection and deliverance is also part of something grander for the benefit of the world at large.
Which is a very strongly Christian ethic, and I don't want to derail the conversation towards, anything outside of the book, but I'm teaching the Aeneid in my classes right now. And in that story, there is a fate. The gods have a will for Aeneas's life. Like, he is going to become the Trojan refugee that founds Rome, but it is not for Aeneas's good. Like, he suffers the whole time. He is full of this lament. He has to do everything he doesn't want to do. He loses his wife. He loses everything in order to fulfill this will, and the gods don't care. And so I really like what you're saying, because the stories that Lewis and Tolkien were surrounded by were not just always governed by this Christian ethic that we, in a sense, take for granted, even though we're a post-Christian society, right? But there are a myriad of stories in world culture in which there is an overarching will, but it does not include the good of the individual. The individual is subsumed in a larger divine will. And that might be good, it might be productive or fruitful, but it is not beneficial to the soul of the agent. And Tolkien is, even though he's not writing allegories for his time, he is speaking to his time. And it was a time in after World War II after World War I, with World War II looming, like, there is this And beyond it, all in one man's lifetime, in a world in which meaning is slipping away, and these are the stories that are being written and put into the public square. There's this modern literature. There's this capital M modern movement. And Tolkien is there saying, this is a meaningful world. It is a benevolent world. It is a comic world. And we can be participants in this larger vision that is salvific beyond us and to us, that it includes also our good. And there is a value, I think, in The Hobbit of just an adventure for the sake of adventure. That's why he goes off and does it. Like, so there's also room, not just for this like heavy burden of responsibility, but also just for like something super cool and fun. And all of that is converging in this story that you can absolutely read it as just a cool adventure story, but there's all these other things going on.
Yeah, I think that's right.
There's a letter, in the, well, I'm reading it out of that new, William Morrow edition with the Tolkien illustrations.
Oh yeah, me too.
And it's got a foreword to the 50th anniversary in it, which I think is in other editions as well. It was written by Christopher Tolkien, his son, in 87. And he concludes the introduction with this letter from a year. I don't know. It just says December 16th. I don't know what year the letter was written. But it was Tolkien writing to Stanley Unwin. And he says, quote, "I did not think any of the stuff I dropped on you filled the bill. I think it is plain that quite apart from it, a sequel or successor to The Hobbit is called for. I promise to give this thought and attention. But I'm sure you will sympathize when I say that the construction of elaborate and consistent mythology and two languages rather occupies the mind, and the Silmarils are in my heart. So that goodness knows what will happen. Mr. Baggins began as a comic tale among conventional and inconsistent Grimm's fairy tale dwarves and got drawn into the edge of it, so that even Sauron the Terrible peeped over the edge. And what more can hobbits do? They can be comic, but their comedy is suburban unless it is set against things more elemental." End quote. I think that speaks to what you're saying there, Heidi. He even uses the word comic, which I imagine he would have been using in multiple ways, not just in the ha-ha way, but also in the ha-ha way. Let's talk about the idea of the songs as relates to this, the prophecies in the old songs. We know that song is a big part of Tolkien's work. It's a big part of this book. People have varying degrees of patience for them and judge them to varying degrees of, you know, their quality in various ways. What role do the songs and slash the prophecies, which I'll use, you know, he kind of uses them in the same way here. What role do those play as relates to this question of luck? Because the things he seems to be saying, things are said in the songs. The songs have predicted it. And yeah, he participated in it, but that doesn't make the songs any less true. Sean, what do you, in your, maybe you have another Tolkien lecture that you could draw upon here on this topic?
Yeah, but 1941. You know,
he talks about, in that quote that I just read, about languages as well. We know how much the notion of like language itself, but also the fun he has with language creation plays into the books. So the songs, the words in those songs, the role they play is obviously a big part of his imagination. But it seems to be getting beyond the fact that he likes songs and words and the way that languages sound to something larger, to something bigger, like that they're participating in a bigger way than just being like an accoutrement to the story, something to give it more vividness. How do you think it plays into this question of luck?
This might be a hard one to tie all the threads together, but I will say, I know that, I mean, Tolkien was a linguist as well as a classicist, and those interests converged primarily in the languages and cultures of the Germanic peoples in Northern Europe, which, you know, in pre-modern times was very much a collection of oral cultures. When things started finally becoming, you know, codified in writing, it was after sort of like we imagine, you know, Homer's poems. It was after a long history and tradition already of songs and sagas and poems being composed and edited and transformed and transmitted orally. And those songs were really the way to capture and incarnate and then continually sort of revisit a culture or a society's deepest concerns and cares and fears and longings. And I think that that is on display in the way that the songs function even here in The Hobbit. It's more dramatic and you know, has a little more gravitas in The Lord of the Rings. But even here, like the opening song, I've probably said it already in these episodes, but I absolutely hate and borderline refuse to acknowledge the existence of the Hobbit films, the Peter Jackson's Hobbit films. However, the scene
I'm going to rewatch them, by the way. Rewatch them. I want to rewatch them with the book fresh in my mind.
Maybe
I'll record myself doing a hate watch.
listen, we should all just do a hate watch of one of them.
All right, let's do it. We'll do it at 1 a.m. sometime.
I'm in.
Yeah, right? Probably the third one where the ridiculous elf dwarf romance is at its height.
The first part of the first one is what I actually want to watch. The first hour.
Well, that's what I was about to say. One of the scenes that they absolutely nail is the dwarves singing the Misty Mountain song in Bilbo's living room. And it's because it's so sincere and it's so stirring and it's a great picture of these longings that these dwarves have, this cultural memory that is both mixed with the joy of the what they've lost and the bitterness over having lost it. All of that is there in the song. And even there, you get the tinges of this unhealthy kind of longing or desire for this treasure, but mixed with, imagining, a prosperous future. And every time we meet people singing throughout the book, it's some version of that. It's really revelatory of what they care about and who they are. And how that ties into the luck question in particular. over to you, Heidi.
Yeah, perfect. I think that we have a lot of prophecies and songs, right?
Yeah.
And Tolkien is going to have to work. He's a Catholic writer writing what is essentially a book that is supposed to feel very religious without being religious, right? And so he's got to work that in somehow. And he succeeds beautifully in that. I don't sense any kind of absence, nor is he being an activist about it. That's like punching you in the face. You need God, modernity, right? he's just writing a great story about a meaningful world. And so I think he uses prophecy and cultural memory as part of the moral vision and part of the meaning-making vision of the story. And so a lot of the future and the past is collected in these songs and poems that are well known by the characters. They have this ritualistic kind of quality and this mournful, lamenting quality that you mentioned, and also this like carrier of joy, right? They're singing together to express any kind of powerful communal or collective experience. And food and song gather the characters together, and the songs are the memory, they are the emotion, and they are the predictors of this kind of coming vision of salvation and restoration. And I think that's why they're so important within this story for the hobbits, the elves, and the dwarves in particular.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, to bring it all the way back around to luck, that I think then that's really excellent. And I think that the songs then are not so much the source of the prophecy as they are a sign that points to this deeper conviction that the characters have that these things will come to pass. And the source of that deeper conviction is not shown to us so explicitly, but the songs are often an expression of that hope or faith or confidence that comes from whatever that deeper source is.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I love that Gandalf is kind of the one, like the very last paragraph of the book, essentially. The idea of songs have been there all along. Elven songs, dwarf songs. Yeah. Bilbo at the end here, he participates in song making. He gets home and the first thing he does is he stops suddenly and he relates a poem or whatever.
And Gandalf comments on it, like, you've really changed. Like the singing from Bilbo demonstrates something to Gandalf. Yeah.
And then, in the last paragraph, it's Gandalf who suggests that these songs, he introduces the notion of them being prophecies. Because Bilbo calls them songs. And then Gandalf introduces that idea.
Yeah.
I do love that. And then the song, of course, that Bilbo tells begins with "the roads go ever on and on," which that comes back around in a future book in a way that becomes very important. Yeah. And Bilbo then he sets to telling his own story, right? He sits down and he begins to write his memoir. And as he's writing it, though, the interesting complexity is that as he's thinking about his story and as he's writing it, he's also sitting on the ring and he's being divided further and further and further and further. And the problem with that becomes more clear, and Gandalf gets suspicious over time, and then we get the Fellowship of the Ring. But I think about those, it's kind of a weird way of putting it, but I sometimes think about those years between the end of The Hobbit and the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring for Bilbo. Yeah. And I wish there was more that we got. I mean, we get little bits of it suggested because Gandalf's been around a time or two and Frodo relates stories and Bilbo has his reputation, but there's all these years. Well, how many years is it again? I don't remember. It's like 75 years. He turns what, 111?
61. He leaves on his 50th birthday, right? And he comes back a year later. He's 51.
And then he's 111.
He's 111.
11th. Yeah.
It's 111st.
Yeah,
that's right.
So there's all those years where he is telling the songs and he's gaining this reputation as being a weirdo, and he's writing his memoir, and the ring is dividing him at the same time.
Yeah. But the other thing that we know, even from the end of The Hobbit, is that what material wealth he's gained from his adventure, he uses mostly in the giving of gifts, right? Mm. And adopting and caring for his orphan nephew.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He never, as divided as he gets by the ring, the only treasure that he clings to is the ring. He doesn't cling to the, he doesn't have the dragon sickness that Thorin gets. His ability to give away the Arkenstone is really important.
Yeah.
Because we know how tantalizing it can be. Even the elves are like, what is that? and the men. Well, let's wrap this conversation up. Any final thoughts? I mean, before the Q&A, final thoughts. Heidi, anything from you?
Well, whenever I make sourdough bread, which is a lot, I like that warm piece in the middle. You know, it's like that has like the crispy outside and like the full chewy inside. We put butter on it. We call that the Arken bread in our house.
The heart of the loaf.
Yes. And we've had many conflicts in our house over who gets the Arken bread.
That's great.
So The Hobbit has left its mark on the culture of our family. That is my final thought.
Amazing. Sean, do you have anything similar?
I don't think I can beat that. No, that's pretty great.
The Arken bread, that's funny.
Heidi and I were talking off air briefly about how easy it is sometimes to take The Hobbit for granted and forget just how great and glorious it is.
So good.
Wait, where was I in this conversation?
You were putting out your fires.
You were like, I have another job.
I was doing
people count on me.
It was off air in the sense that we weren't recording, and I was sitting here ignoring what you guys were talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you fell off like the recording. You would have heard it.
Oh yeah, my internet.
We weren't like
yeah,
doing it right. without you. Like, quick, that's talk right. about well, the Hobbit without David.
You can have a text thread or whatever phone call without me. It's like not.
We
it's
don't. Just
like, I mean,
we only talk.
Little, yeah, a little bit of FOMO. I mean,
yeah, no,
we don't do that.
Yeah,
well, except you just did it. You had made a great episode out of it.
Oh man, well, that's true, but only because we were coasting on the yada yada. No, but I just it was great to acknowledge that, especially this experience of sitting down with the intention of considering The Hobbit as something great and brilliant and complex and satisfying. Mm. It was, you know, delivered on all of those things. It really is so great. And I almost feel bad about just, or I'm not always thinking about it that way. Whenever I fail to sort of hold it up kind of, next to The Lord of the Rings and think of it as like, you know, sub second rate Tolkien. I don't usually do that, but, you know, it's easy to kind of forget how good it is. And this has been
so a blast. I get asked all the time in the shop, where should I start with Tolkien?
Yeah,
because we have this big, well, relatively big Tolkien section, and
it's a healthy Tolkien section.
We're named Goldberry and all that. Yeah, I mean, I'd like it to be bigger, but
yeah.
So people ask me that have never read him, where do we start? Do we start with the Fellowship of the Ring? And I think you have to start with The Hobbit because
you gotta start with The Hobbit.
I mean, you can read The Fellowship of the Ring. He does some work for you to kind of summarize things, right?
Yeah.
But I think that the spirit of what Tolkien's after and the things that matter to him begin to emerge in really excellent and delightful ways in this book.
Yeah.
Like who hobbits are, the world that the role that dwarves play, that Gandalf plays, like all those things come into focus in a way that prepare you for the depth of the Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And once you've learned to, when you've discovered the world and you've spent some time in it and you find it delightful, then going deeper in the Lord of the Rings is even more fun, as opposed to, you know, I think I get people who say, oh, I've never read past the Fellowship of the Ring. I never read past like halfway through the Fellowship of the Ring. It got too slow. And I always ask them, did you read The Hobbit first? And almost always they say no, because they think The Hobbit is a kid's book.
Yeah.
And so I always say, no, go back and read The Hobbit and start over, get into the world, get into the story, get into the things that matter to Tolkien, get into the songs, participate in that. And then
you'll just
dive
want
into
it.
The rest of it.
Yeah.
And I think that, I can see your point that it's easy to hold it up and say, well, it's not as epic as The Lord of the Rings. It doesn't have as many ideas as The Lord of the Rings, but that doesn't mean that it's not planting the seeds for what is going to come. Just like Heidi's about to go outside and plant seeds in her garden for the harvest that is to come.
Yeah, I'm going to get it together. Yeah.
During that
and
one
that.
Week when you can harvest in Colorado.
And I even, as a kid,
exactly.
I have a horrible personal tragedy that's connected to The Hobbit. When I was in grade school,
you're gonna end the conversation with this?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, but it's to your point. When I was in grade school, there was a sixth grade teacher who she was kind of famous for teaching The Hobbit in her class, and so I didn't read The Hobbit. I was kind of waiting to read The Hobbit with Mrs. Handley. Sixth grade is too late anyway, but my school was, it was goofy. We studied, it's terrible. Yeah. My school was not an excellent institution of education, but Mrs. Handley really did it up with The Hobbit in sixth grade. She even had this when they finished reading The Hobbit, they had like a Hobbit hat day where everybody picked a character and you like designed a hat that character would wear and, dress up as that character and have a big Hobbit party. So looking forward to this.
Figure out what house you're going to be in and all that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the beginning of sixth grade arrives and there is like a preview day. Like at the beginning of the school year, you come and you drop off your school supplies and you see your classroom and things. And then the real thing starts the next week. And I show up at school and go to the sixth grade classroom and all the little cubbies are labeled with people's names and I don't see my name anywhere. And and it's because
another
that
teacher.
Summer they added a second section of sixth grade, and I got put in the new teacher's class. And I gotta say,
sad.
That teacher, let's call her Mrs. Pumford. She wasn't the same.
Plumford.
We didn't read The Hobbit at all.
Oh.
She was coming from teaching kindergartners, and so she talked to us like kindergartners all year. She was a vegetarian, and she brought us vegetarian meatballs for the class Christmas party. I'm not making this stuff up.
This is really sad.
Yeah. And so I didn't end up reading The Hobbit until I was...
I'm really sorry.
Yeah. I was in middle school when I read The Hobbit for the first time. But it was as a lead up to reading The Lord of the Rings for the first time. And they really did. It was such a natural progression to just read them as four books in a series. You won't be disappointed if you start with The Hobbit. Long story short.
Yeah.
But don't wait. Right. Crying out loud. Don't wait for Mrs. Hanley, because you might not get Mrs. Hanley.
You might not get her. I'm really sorry that happened.
Yeah, it's all right.
Have you ever made a Hobbit hat? Like a redemption hat?
You know, that's a great idea. I should do that with my kids or something. I never have. Yeah, I need to go and get some closure on that.
You do. Which one? Really? What character do you think you're going to pick? I would pick Gandalf.
I would pick Gandalf. I mean, Gandalf would be great because you could sort of do the beard. I guess you could do that with any of the dwarves. Or you could do Bjorn. Ooh, kind of a bear head. Yeah, that'd be fun. I don't know. I got to think about this.
I would not do a spider. Go ahead, David.
Speaking of the dwarves, quick aside here before we go, and we do need to go. I was surprised this time how offhanded the comment is about Feely and Keely bravely staying with Thorin and getting killed. It just kind of like, and Feely and Keely were dead as well because
they're dead too.
Yeah.
I know.
Because they were his sister's sons.
When I was growing up, my aunt babysat some other kids that were, and one of the girls was named Keely. And every time we hung out, I was just like, so do you know about The Hobbit? She didn't.
Bet I don't think she knew
about The Hobbit.
It's a dude's name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. No,
Keely's a
what's wrong with
name.
Your parents? Anyway, you should probably go.
Okay.
Fair enough.
We will do another hour plus on The Hobbit next time when we answer your questions. So please feel free to post more than one if you like. I mean, you can post as many questions as you want. We can't guarantee we'll get to all of them, but we'll do our best. So that thread will be over there on Substack at closereads.substack.com over on the chat feature. It's great if you're using the app, but you can also go to the website and you can click the chat button across the top menu and you can see the different threads there. So we're going to post a thread there. And I'll also send that out. You'll get an email pin, like it'll ping you that we're doing the Q&A and you can participate in that.
Ping.
And also on the episode comments, if you want to tell us what your kids think of, like what they love about this book as well, that would be great. When we'll share some of those as well. After that, we're going to be reading Trust. So start with that. That book is written in four parts. So each of the episodes will be on one of those parts. So episode one will be on part one of Trust. And I believe Tim will be back for that as well. So lots of great stuff going on, as we said. And thanks to everyone who's listening. Thanks to everyone who supports the show on Substack or by leaving a review or sharing about it with a friend. Sharing the show with a friend is probably a better way of saying it. And thanks, of course, to Logan Green for audio engineering it. And he doesn't like it when I say producing, who edits it and engineers it and makes it so that it sounds the way it's supposed to sound. Because when we record, we have a lot of technical problems. And so thank you to him. Usually they're just internet related, making things laggy like today, but Logan makes it so you don't even notice.
Right.
All right. Well, for Sean Johnson, Riley White, David Kern, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.